Hello, everyone. I would like to begin Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 66. We have really finished the decanates, but I noticed, well, you never finish the decanates. There's so much to be thought about it. But I wanted to read what Alice Bailey had said in the Labors of Hercules. There are three constellations in Aquarius, or let's say three zodiacal, extra zodiacal constellations in Aquarius. The southern fish, or Pisces Australis, picturing in connection with Aquarius the coming of world saviors. I think that applies to the entire sign, really. The world savior has a strong Saturnian obligation, and is sacrificial in many respects, and also has a strong Venusian note. So again, you know, whether it's the first or the third decanate we're talking about, the idea of the world savior would apply. Note that here in the culmination of Pisces, we have one fish, the avatar, not the two fishes banded together. So this is the greater fish. Well, it could even be the spirit in a certain sense, not the two fishes, soul and personality. And notice that Piscis Australis or Austrinus or Pisces Australis is mentioned first. Not necessarily that this gives us the unequivocal hint as to where, to which decanate this particular constellation can be associated. If we go with the idea that given three extra zodiacal constellations and three decanates, there is a direct association, okay? But we have Piscis Australis first. The second constellation is Pegasus, the winged horse, ever the inspiring symbol of the higher mind or even of the world of ideas. In the plane of air, flying in the plane of air, and of course we have the Buddhic plane specifically as the plane of air, but there's more to it. All of the cosmic ethers are air when compared with earth of the lower three subplanes. Ever the inspiring symbol of the higher mind, love spurning the earth, at home in the air. And on a lower level, we are reminded of the winged feet of Mercury. This horse has wings, of course. Ever wings of the mind. Remembering also that one definition of love is the clear, cold light of reason. So, as we discussed in our last webinar, number 65, Pegasus is at home in the triadal levels and can fly via Mercury via the intuition into the cosmic ethers and there perhaps bring back the lightning bolts of ideas. The third constellation takes yet a further flight, for we have Cygnus the swan flying in mid-heaven, well, maybe in the highest heaven. This is the swan of eternity flying in time and space. Sometimes we have the idea of the swan or the hamsa outside of time and space. It is the symbol of life itself, the cleansing, purifying, living waters of Aquarius. So from the perspective of these three constellations as given here, and I don't think Alice Bailey wrote this because she was not able to finish her commentary beyond Virgo, I believe. But nevertheless, the order is interesting. First Piscis Australis, then Pegasus, and then Cygnus, the swan, I think, in a way, representing not only the soul, but the spirit, life itself. And the idea here is the swan of eternity within time and space, but we also have the great bird outside of time and space as well. And I think there is some suggestion that Cygnus could represent that. One of the ways that Cygnus represents the soul, or the solar angel, is here given. This is taken from the Wikipedia. There's a story here about two close friends, Cygnus and Phaeton. Phaeton, we know, of course, is associated with the chariot and with the sun and with driving too close. They were continually competing. One day, they each challenged the other to a race across the sky, around the sun and back to earth. In an effort to gain the advantage, they both cut too close to the sun. So this is the symbol of seeking identification with spirit too rapidly before the form is prepared to withstand it. They both cut too close to the sun, and their chariots were burned up. Oh, well, you know, we often talk about the burnout that we can go through, or what the frying that can happen to us if we let loose the spiritual energies in our nature too rapidly before the form can really bear them or stand them. They both fell to earth and were knocked unconscious. This is interesting. The loss of consciousness, perhaps, of who they really were. Upon recovering, Cygnus began looking for his friend. Now, the depth of unconsciousness here is deeper for Phaeton. I think Cygnus awoke earlier. Cygnus began looking for his friend Phaeton and discovered his body trapped by the roots of a tree at the bottom of the Eridanus River. Well, he is rooted in the earth, and the Eridanus River is the river of souls by which human beings come into incarnation. Hence the association possibly with the Saturnian decanate in Taurus. In an effort, that is the river Eridanus associated with the Saturnian decanate in Taurus. That's not absolutely decided because we have Saturn and Venus and we have to apportion Orion and also Eridanus in the proper place. In an effort to retrieve his friend's body and give it a proper burial, Cygnus repeatedly dove into the river. In other words, Cygnus didn't have to. This is the river of souls taking incarnation. And poor Phaeton is rooted deep in the earth. He is deep in incarnation. He is unconscious and lost in the process of incarnation. But Cygnus could not reach his friend's body. He could not find Phaeton, so deeply immersed was Phaeton. While he sat grieving on the bank of the river, Cygnus begged for Zeus to help. Zeus replied that if he gave Cygnus the body of a swan, which is, of course, a great, beautiful, and Venusian bird, he would be able to dive deeply enough to retrieve his friend's body. In other words, pull us out of incarnation and redeem the lower consciousness so deeply rooted in the incarnational process. However, if Cygnus did take the body of a swan, he would also be giving up his immortality. So the solar angels are the great immortals, but from a certain point of view, when they infuse our substance with an aspect of themselves, they share, at least in terms of consciousness, in our cyclic mortality, and would live only as long as a swan would normally live. Cygnus readily agreed to this in order to retrieve his friend's body. This seems a very apt kind of a story to represent Cygnus as the immortal swan diving deeply enough into time and space, to deeply enough so that an aspect of his freedom is sacrificed. The sacrifice is the key here. Cygnus readily agreed to this in order to retrieve his friend's body and give him a proper burial, allowing his friend's spirit to travel into the afterlife, which apparently it could not do, so deeply immersed was it. But Zeus did recognize his sacrifice. In honor of this great unselfish act, Zeus placed Cygnus' image, that of a swan, in the night sky. And so we have the idea of the solar angel in the form of a swan diving down to pull us up, and in a way sacrificing an aspect of his own immortality, at least for a long time engaged in the cyclic mortality of the human being, but somehow able to redeem this human being so it can rise into the more subtle worlds, which I think here the afterlife represents. So in a way, Cygnus is a very good symbol of the soul or solar angel, but from another point of view, it represents life or spirit and the swan out of time and space altogether, a great, beautiful bird of eternity, which Madame Blavatsky discusses as the Hamsa. And then, of course, there's also the Paramahamsa, which emphasizes the freedom. I've been told by someone I trust here that the third degree initiate is known as the Hamsa and the fourth degree as the Paramahamsa. Now, anyway, we want to know some of these meanings of the extra zodiacal constellations, whether or not we associate them with a particular decanate, or whether the Aquarian individual has a connection with all of these kinds of influences. And I think the latter is the case. The Aquarian has a connection with all of them, but perhaps there is a specific resonance between one extra zodiacal constellation and one of the decanates. But that is speculative, and we will have to test that out in our own psyche. Here is Pegasus and Bellerophon, riding Pegasus. He is the hero who subdued, or at least tamed, this particular horse. There are genealogies for these beings. And let's just see a little bit about Pegasus. He's one of the best-known mythological figures in Greek mythology, a winged divine horse, usually white in color. This symbolizes the idea of the purified personality, which, if sufficiently purified, can attain wings and is no longer elemental in nature, but is more angelic in nature, can fly into the higher worlds via the Mercurian intuition, but only after purification has occurred. It's not a black horse, is it? He was sired by Poseidon, who is virtually Neptune, and his role as horse god. That Poseidon is that because the horses are the emotions. Horses are the symbol for the emotions over which sixth ray Poseidon presides. And foaled by the Gorgon Medusa, this is in the world of illusion, and the snakes of Medusa represent all of the different forms of Maya glamour and illusion to which we can be subjected. He was the brother of Cressaor, born at a single birthing when his mother was decapitated by Perseus. And the Greco-Roman poets write about his ascent to heaven after his birth and his obeisance to Zeus, king of the gods. This is the part of ourselves that flies into the heavens and has close association with the gods in their domain. And their domain is the cosmic ethers. And Zeus instructed him to bring lightning and thunder from Olympus. Well, I guess we can talk about the power of ideas. Sometimes Master Moria speaks of the lightning of thought. And here we have the flashing forth of ideas from the higher realms and the great sound that they make, which arrest everybody's attention. The thunder is a frightening sound, and it shows the power and the might of the higher realms. Lightning and thunder involved with Pegasus. At least one of the traditions says so. He's the friend of the muses. He's the creator of Hippocrene, the fountain on Mount Helicon. Presumably, we're dealing here with a rain cloud of knowable things and how one can derive from this fountain all manner of heavenly missives and ideas and the beings that come from the higher heavens. Ideas are those beings. He was captured by the Greek hero Bellerophon near the fountain of Pirene with the help of Athena, that crafty goddess, and Poseidon, his father. Pegasus allows the hero to ride him to defeat a monster, the Chimera, or the Chimera, who is again the representation of all the glamours and illusions of the lower world. And these illusions can be defeated by the inflow of intuitive ideas from the realm of intuition, not the mind itself, but the intuition defeats illusion. So we could even put that in there if we wish to. It is the intuition which defeats the chimera, chimera, however you want to pronounce that, which is illusion, and had other exploits. His rider, however, falls off his back trying to reach Mount Olympus. Always there are these stories of trying to go too high, trying to come too close to the gods, and not succeeding. Zeus transformed him into the constellation Pegasus and placed him in the sky. I assume that means the horse itself, how he rose into immortality in the sky. So we have to be careful about how we ride Pegasus, how high we strive to reach. We are attempting to reach the heights, but we must be prepared. And Pegasus people, under Mercury and under the Gemini part, may attempt without preparation to reach into the heights, and this has to be a tendency which is tamed and regulated. There are many variants of the myths. He's the symbol of wisdom and especially of fame from the Middle Ages until the Renaissance. He says the symbolism varies with time. Symbol of wisdom, well, that's up in the cosmic ethers. He became the symbol of poetry, the flights of poetic flights, and the creator of the sources in which poets come to draw in from inspiration. I think that's very important. What are those sources? They are found in the intuitive realms and the cosmic etheric realms. So, creator of the sources in which the poets come to draw inspiration, particularly in the 19th century. He's found in the icons. Iconography is very rich. It says personification of the water, solar myth, or shaman mount. Carl Jung and his followers have seen in Pegasus a profound symbol of esoteric, symbolic esoteric, in relation to the spiritual energy that allows access to the realm of the gods on Mount Olympus. Well, I think we can all agree with that. A profound symbolic esoteric, well, is that a noun? In relation to the spiritual energy which allows access to the realm of the gods. Okay, well, there's all kinds of things here, but each one of us has to become Pegasus, in a sense. We are the personality. We do have our emotions. We do have Neptune and the realm of emotions. If we have wings, we can fly from the astral plane to the Buddhic plane. There is that astral Buddhic leap, and perhaps Pegasus is the symbol of the way of achieving that leap into Buddhi from high aspirational emotion. The springs are bursting forth when Pegasus strikes the earth. There is rapture. There is at the behest of Poseidon to prevent the mountain swelling with rapture at the song of the Muses. Oh yes, interesting. Pegasus was peacefully drinking from a spring when the hero Bellerophon captured him. And the Pegasus carried thunderbolts for Zeus. Well, there are many things that can be said here, but we just want to get the idea of flight, of inspiration, of aviation, of taking off, of no longer being bound in the lower aspects of the personality. Not much is said about Piscus Ostrinus. There are perhaps a few things, and I'm wondering... Whoops, this is not going to be, yeah, okay. Extra zodiacal constellations, and maybe I will try to make this just a little easier. Okay, the southern fish, let's see if anything really of note is, well, you know, there is one fish. There's one fish and there are two fishes, and the greater fish ends up being the more important. The greater fish, and is portrayed as swallowing the water being poured out by Aquarius. I think we referred to that act. The two fishes of the constellation Pisces are said to be the offspring of the greater fish. It's like unity, bringing forth offspring of duality. In Egyptian mythology, this fish saved the life of the Egyptian goddess Isis, who was really serious in a way. So she placed the fish and its descendants, including Pisces, into the heaven as constellation of stars. The thing that is most impressive to me, swallowing the water poured forth by Aquarius, well, one can do that for oneself, or one can do that absorbing this great stream of beneficent energy from the heavens in order to save and distribute this energy in acts of salvation. So here we have the saving fish, particularly. There are all kinds of things. Here's, let's see, what is the name of this? Ian Ridpath's Star Tales. This we could enter and discover more, but I don't want to get too far off the track. The idea is here that there is an absorption of the waters poured forth by Aquarius, and it's the symbol, perhaps, of the world savior being able to be so thoroughly equipped, so thoroughly embodying these energies as to be able to do great good with them. Of course, at the same time, swallowing can be a selfish act, so we have to look at the negative side of it as well, and this would have to be studied in relation to particular people and groups and so forth. All right, now that's a little bit of an extension, and let's just see. Yes, here we are. So we have finished number 65, and I just wanted to say those few things about the extra zodiacal constellations. I also want to remind us, when we look at Aquarius, that the first decanate from 0 to 10 is solely ruled by Aquarius. The second, or Pegasus decanate, by Aquarius Gemini. We call, you know, Gemini with its flights of fancy and its difficulty in rooting itself upon the planet. DK tells us that somehow the seventh ray is missing, although the image of the pillars from the past suggests the strength of the seventh ray. When we look at Gemini, all the other rays are present on the cross, but not the seventh ray. Of course, I think that could be said for all of the mutable cross, but he brings that out in Gemini, and he talks about the difficulty which Masonry has had in anchoring itself upon the earth. Masonry, a peculiarly Geminian fraternal order. So the idea of being able to fly away from the earth and to receive all manner of ideas, particularly attuned with the higher realms and bringing them down, but not really anchoring them. So this has a very strong connection with the Pegasus type of imagery, which is involved with flight more than it is with walking steadily upon the ground. And then Aquarius Libra, that is the third decanate. And of course the Venus corresponds very well there as the ruler of the third decanate. Venus as ruler of Libra, Mercury as ruler of the second decanate, and also as ruler of Gemini, that works well. And Saturn, at least, as one of the rulers of Aquarius. Uranus is not given. Usually the trans-Saturnian planets are not assigned to decanates, usually. And Saturn, for a long time, has been considered the ruler of Aquarius, and so it is assigned as the first decanate, and so that works out very symmetrically with the rulerships, but it is not always the case, as we well realize. All right, now we have the Tibetan making a transition here. He's talking about what we're going to do after we visit Aquarius. So we're moving clockwise through the zodiac. We're going to visit Capricorn. We shall next consider Capricorn at some length, a most mysterious constellation, far more mysterious than exoteric astrology indicates. We shall next consider Capricorn at some length. These three studies of Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and of course Aries before it. It was a rather long chapter, will be slightly longer than the succeeding ones, as I have been laying the foundation of what I have to say under our fifth point, which will be the three crosses, and he will take these up later, later in the book. And the charts of the crosses will be one of the new ways of expanding the esoteric depth of astrology. But we have to get through these number of hundreds of pages first, and then hopefully we'll be able to go into some discussion of the charts of the crosses. We shall have brought out certain considerations in connection with them, these signs, that will be of value. Pisces is part of the mutable cross. That was interesting. Pisces, Scorpio, and one other, Pisces, Scorpio, and one other, yes, Capricorn. Those were the three constellations most related, each from a different cross, most related to the human kingdom. We remember discussing that. Pisces is part of the mutable cross, Aquarius of the fixed cross, and Capricorn of the cardinal cross, and there will therefore be no need to repeat in such detail what I have here said when we are discussing the other signs. Okay, these three signs are beginning signs or final signs. The first three are climactic three, when moving counterclockwise around the wheel, or they are initiatory three, when moving in the clockwise manner, according to the state of the wheel of life. Now remember, this is, you know, Aries is always the beginning. But often, when moving on the clockwise wheel, let's see if I say clockwise wheel, what happens? Yeah, it does. When moving on the clockwise wheel, we begin with Pisces, and DK often numbers the signs in the clockwise manner as if a beginning has been made in Pisces. But sometimes he does begin in Aries and move backwards, as if Aries is sign number one, fits with the first ray, Pisces sign number two, second ray, and Aquarius sign number three, in which the third ray, we have noticed, is prominent. So he's talking about these three signs, either of beginning or of consummation. We've seen that the initiate does reach heights of achievement in Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces, and they are signs which are often related to the later initiations, the third, the fourth, and even the fifth, and these we have seen in the lives of some rather spectacular people, Swami Vivekananda, we've seen Ramakrishna involved in the Aquarius Pisces, we've seen Francis Bacon involved in Aquarius, we have the association of Pisces with the Christ, and so forth. So some of those who are ending their long journey, pilgrimage as a human being, are focusing in those latter signs as third-degree initiates and beyond. Let's see what's said here. They also sum up or initiate the activities of the other nine signs, which are fundamentally, strictly human signs, and synthesize the results of experience upon the three cross. Let's look at that. They also sum up or initiate the activities of the other nine signs, which are fundamentally strictly human signs, and synthesize the results of experience upon the three crosses. Well, they do synthesize the results. Capricorn synthesizing, in a way, the cardinal cross, Aquarius synthesizing the fixed cross, Pisces synthesizing the mutable cross, but to call the other nine signs, including Aries, as strictly, fundamentally strictly human, well, we will have to investigate that. From Aries, through Sagittarius, we have nine signs which DK says are fundamentally, strictly human. Okay, now at other points he talks about human signs in a different way. And some of the signs have human figures like Gemini and Aquarius, you know. So Aquarius actually has a human figure in it, and he refers to them as related to the human kingdom. So there are different perspectives on what makes something human. Sometimes he talks about Aries, Taurus, and Gemini, one of them having the human being in them, as if they are very subjective and not so much related to human development at all, but are strictly that which initiates human development. So from a certain perspective, we have remaining then, from Cancer through Sagittarius, the human stages of development. Can we say that the human being leaves the human kingdom when becoming the initiate in Capricorn? Not exactly, but certainly is a higher type of human being. Well, anyway, let us say that from Cancer through Sagittarius, we have strictly human signs, those that are very much concerned with the normal type of human development, neither too subjective as Aries, Taurus, Gemini, or too climactic as Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces. So really we're looking at six signs and six signs, aren't we? Interesting. And six of these signs are abstracted from strictly human development, and six of the signs are absorbed in the human process. We shall now be able to cover our present thesis, anent the philosophical implications of the great wheel. I guess that's what he's teaching us. The philosophical implications of the great wheel far more rapidly, as I can now leave what else remains to be said in connection with the three crosses until I come to that part of our section. Until I come to that part of our section six. Well, okay. There I shall have much of interest to point out. So we have been studying, essentially, what DK calls a treatise on the philosophical implications of the great wheel of the zodiac. And by philosophy we mean that higher perspective on the meaning of these signs when applied to the great pilgrimage of human development. What place do they have in the cosmos? This we are attempting to learn. Anyway, DK is an efficient teacher and has laid out many of the preliminaries at first so that he can move more rapidly. There I shall have much of interest to point out in this section 6. I have dealt with these three crosses at some length whilst we were covering these first three signs of the zodiacal wheel. And not really so much the cardinal cross. The cardinal cross has not been thoroughly considered. But we do remember there was a thorough consideration of the fixed cross, rather, the mutable cross, followed by a slightly less thorough consideration of the fixed cross, but still ample, and he has not done this so much, but he will in Cancer do this and talk about the four great themes, which are, I think, creation, manifestation, legislation, and initiation, Aries through Capricorn, respectively, on the cardinal cross. Okay. So I've dealt with these three crosses at some length whilst we were covering these first three signs of the zodiacal wheel as it revolves from Aries through Pisces to Taurus. Each of these three is found on one of the crosses, and these are the three climactic signs we're talking about, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces, and thus in themselves and in their relationship they constitute a complete unit. Well, they are certainly a unit of initiation. They are a, what can we call them? These three are a climactic unit, a synthetic or synthesizing unit. They synthesize, we are told, the different qualities of each of the crosses, different energies. They are absorbing. It's interesting that we have three synthesizing planets. Let's just say, just as there are three synthesizing planets, there are three synthesizing signs. Our synthesizing planets, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Well, I think we can see that the synthesizing planets are related to the synthesizing signs. With Saturn related to Capricorn, Uranus to Aquarius, and Neptune to Pisces. Neptune, you know, which is really the last of the synthesizing planets? That's a good question. Because, in a way, we're in a second-ray solar system, and Neptune might hold the highest position, being a second-ray monad in a second-ray solar system. But Uranus, of course, is in a way king of the gods and has a first-ray monad and probably will rise to its most prominent position in the next solar system, which will be a first-ray solar system. It is interesting to note how these three signs are either those of commencement upon the mutable cross or of consummation upon the fixed cross. We're talking about the cross of form. We're not talking about the mutable signs. We're talking about consciousness on the fixed cross. So Aries, rather not Aries, but Pisces, Aquarius, and Capricorn are signs of commencement. How interesting to think of them in that way. It's not usually the way they are thought of. Or of consummation upon the fixed cross, as the fixed cross is getting ready to allow the man to transfer to the cardinal cross. In the case where they stand for beginning, and we're talking here, well, he's changed this a little bit. He's, this is interesting. We were discussing Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces as signs of synthesis, but now he has shifted the discussion. See, look at here. Indeed, he has discussed Pisces on the mutable cross, Aquarius on the fixed cross, and Capricorn on the cardinal cross. Right, but now he's going to take Aries will take the place of Capricorn, which is interesting, and in fact it does do that. Later, in a higher initiatory stage of our planet, the sign of initiation will not be Capricorn so much as it will be Aries. So there has been a shift here, and we have to see why this should be the case. Notice the shift with Aries taking the place of Capricorn. Now, as I have said, we oftentimes begin with Pisces, and he numbers the signs as if they begin with Pisces. You know, sometimes he calls Scorpio the fifth sign. Well, if he began with Aries moving clockwise, he couldn't do that. But he begins with Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, Sagittarius, Scorpio. Scorpio then is the fifth sign beginning with Pisces. Okay, this shift, one has to follow carefully. But certainly Aries is a climactic sign. It's both the beginning and the end. So when they stand for beginning, we have Aries is the first aspect, and its movement out into incarnation, let form again be sought. It's the first aspect latent, it says. The will to manifest. Aries has the first and seventh ray, which are manifestational rays. It's involved with the will to create, especially. And it gives experience upon the cardinal cross, but in the mutable cross phase of consciousness. So that's the first aspect. And I did discuss this idea earlier of Aries being the first aspect, and Pisces being the second, and Aquarius the third. It's also possible to begin with Pisces, where Pisces would represent, well, there's different ways of doing this. Pisces can represent the second aspect or the first aspect, or even the third, because water is matter. So Pisces can represent the third aspect, Aquarius the second, and Capricorn the first, moving in the clockwise direction. But anyway, here we are on the mutable cross of consciousness, considering three signs, one cardinal, one mutable, and one fixed, and we're moving in the clockwise direction. Pisces, a great cosmic decanate, holds the second aspect latent, its desire for form existence, the love or desire for material things. And we don't usually think of Pisces in that way, because we have been conditioned to think of Pisces as quite a spiritual sign, a sign of detachment. But in the earlier days, there is a great connection with matter and with that which is constituted out of matter, and there is constant change and mutation. So we have the great kaleidoscope of material substance. Things are ever shifting and changing, and there is no stability. This we have often noticed in the Piscean life. And then, when we're still on the mutable cross in consciousness, we're looking at these signs of commencement or signs of consummation. He did say that Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces were signs of consummation, but he seems to be going to say that Aquarius, Pisces, and Aries will be signs of consummation. In Aquarius, a kind of a third-ray consummation, in Pisces, a second-ray consummation, and finally, in Aries, which is the beginning and the end, a first-ray consummation. Excuse me. Aquarius has the third aspect latent, so that confirms the third ray in Aquarius. Consecration to the service of the lower self. Whatever that the lower self desires, that will be supplied. Okay. Whatever. I should make this maybe a little bit smaller. Whatever the lower self desires will be supplied. Okay. Selfishness. Experience on the fixed cross. Now, how very different that is. It's experienced upon the fixed cross in the mutable cross phase of consciousness. How very different to think of the Aquarian, who is the great, eventually liberated world server, as being initially selfish. But of course, the natives, the human beings in the early days, born in or under all the signs, are selfish. That is simply the stage that they are passing through on the mutable cross. When these three signs form the end of the cycle of expression upon the reverse wheel, then you have, okay, just let me pause here for just one moment. Okay. Okay. Now we're talking about these signs as signs of consummation. Yes, there are three sets, two sets of three, which are consummation. And as I say, there is Aquarius and Pisces, always signs of consummation, but sometimes Capricorn, in a way, and sometimes Aries, especially when we are finally on the cardinal cross. So Aquarius, which gives us the third aspect expressed, consecration to the service of the whole, is quite different from selfishness. The death or negation of all personality selfishness, which is a Leonian trait and a solar Amkaric trait. So the sun is in detriment in Aquarius, so there's the death of all personality selfishness, because the sun is in detriment. Culmination of the experience upon the fixed cross. Now, let's see. Presumably in the fixed cross stage of the revolution of the wheel, counterclockwise. This is important, though. The death or negation of all personality selfishness. And I want to make a note there, and do it in a somewhat smaller manner, that the sun is in detriment. The sun or Ahamkara, sun or Ahamkara is in detriment. It's not all lined up very well, but you get the idea. Now we have another sign of consummation, the second aspect expressed. Notice, though, with Aquarius, it really is the third aspect, isn't it? And so we will have, although DK has not said that the third ray, not very often at least, that the third ray is coming through Aquarius, we can expect this third ray and third aspect to be quite prominent during the Aquarian age, and we can expect that the Master R, who is the Mahachohan and therefore monadically the wielder of the third ray, will be very active in producing the necessary reconfigurations, rearrangements, combinations during the Aquarian age. Perhaps the energy flows towards the right type of manifestation will begin to occur in the Aquarian age. And I think after that long period of adjustment under Saturn, this will be very much the case when we reach Mercury, which itself is a profoundly third-ray planet. Then we come to Aries, the first aspect expressed. Appearance of the will to cooperate with the plan. The death of self-will. Culmination of experience upon the cardinal cross. Well, oftentimes, you know, Aries and Pisces are like one sign, and we have in Pisces, not my will, but thine be done. But also here in Aries, the idea of identifying with the great will. Again, not my will, but thine be done, and probably very assertively. Culmination of the experience upon the cardinal cross, though I would say probably in the, well, it could be in the very last part of the fixed cross in consciousness stage, but it also, well, we cannot talk about culmination of experience upon the cardinal cross phase of consciousness being, because it's just too distant from us. When we are becoming a fourth degree initiate, we are, well, we're on neither cross, but we're certainly only beginning the development upon the cardinal cross, and even when we're becoming a fifth degree initiate, it's still at the very beginning of the cardinal cross consciousness being experience. So we can't really talk about culmination of experience upon the cardinal cross in terms of the cardinal cross phase of consciousness being. So this is more or less, let us say, the fixed cross stage, or maybe the beginning of the cardinal cross phase at the fifth degree. I think Aries has a lot to do with mastership. It's the beginning of an entirely new relationship to the hierarchy. One stands as a master. One stands as a director and an initiator of ashramic projects. So you see why I'm hesitant there. I think all of these, did DK say so? Upon the reverse wheel. Well, the reverse wheel is largely the wheel of the fixed cross. The wheel of the fixed cross. But the very last culmination here in Aries suggests something more than just the fixed cross, but it doesn't suggest the finality of life upon the cardinal cross, because where does that end anyway? All right, moving on. The same basic mode of considering the three crosses can be carried out with Gemini, Taurus, Aries, or the reverse, Aries, Taurus, Gemini. Well, you see what he's doing here. He's always using Aries as a beginning or ending point. At least here he is, although he began talking about Pisces as an ending point and a synthesizing point. He uses Aries as a beginning or ending point in this particular discussion, at least. Now, if we go higher up where we were before, Aries through Pisces to Taurus, each of these three is found upon one of the crosses. Now, which three are we talking about? He has been talking about, well, here it is, the three crosses. We have brought out certain considerations with them, which will be of value. And he's talking about the study of Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, we shall bring out certain considerations in connection with them. Pisces is part of the mutable cross, and we will have no need. The three signs are beginning or final signs, according to these three signs. Well, there it is. These three signs, which are Pisces, Aquarius, and Capricorn, are beginning or final signs according to the stage of the Wheel of Life. But then, when he goes on to describe the beginning or final signs, he always includes Aries instead of Capricorn. They sum up or initiate the activities of the other nine signs, which are fundamentally or strictly human signs. That's why I asked, even Aries? And then, sure enough, when we go just a little bit farther down, he substitutes Aries for Capricorn. They are both synthesizing signs, but Aries has more to do with the mysteries of spirit and of being, and Capricorn more to do with the mysteries of the life of the soul. They are both signs in which the third initiation can be taken, and of course Aquarius as well. And at the third initiation, the mysteries of being begin to be revealed, because a man is coming more in conscious touch with his monad. So this happens at the third degree, where either or both Capricorn and Aries do preside. All right, now moving right along here. Yes, he's going to discuss the same kind of beginning and ending. He's going to stick with Aries as the beginning point. And he's going to say, the same basic mode of considering the three crosses can be carried out with Gemini, Taurus, Aries, or the reverse, Aries, Taurus, and Gemini, remembering always that the mutable cross governs the wheel in ordinary progress, and the fixed cross governs it on the reversed process during discipleship. And can we say then that the cardinal cross could be governing the wheel turning in all directions, both processes, but this is only understood when initiation has been taken. So he seems to be suggesting that the cardinal cross governs the wheel turning on itself in all directions. And the cardinal cross supervises a stage of development which is extremely long. As I say, Sanat Kumara, who is Mahamanvantara's ahead of the average human being, is on the cardinal cross. The planetary logos is on the cardinal cross, and I suspect our solar logos and so forth. I don't know of any other crosses. But then, once we go beyond the jurisdiction of the zodiac and we leave, in a way, the province of the one about whom naught may be said, we can no longer speak in terms of our particular zodiacal 12. So the crosses of which we discuss, the crosses we have been discussing, will no longer be operative. Maybe there'll be a higher correspondence to these crosses. But remember that the zodiacal constellations are the heart and the head center of the one about whom naught may be said. So if we were to go beyond our local super-constellational logos, which we call the one about whom naught may be said, we would not be dealing with our particular cardinal, fixed, and mutable crosses. We'd have to look for some kind of higher correspondences. But, you know, that's so far away and so far ahead that we might as well learn a lot about what's going on within our local one about whom naught may be said, about whom we can say nothing, really. Nothing meaningful, I suppose. So, here we go with Aries. And we are taking this in the counterclockwise direction. We are not taking it in the... we're not taking this in the clockwise direction. We're not taking this on the wheel of form or on the stage of the Ahamkaric stage, the stage of self, the stage of selfishness on the mutable cross. Okay, Aries governs the path of discipleship. How interesting, or at least initiating one's treading of the path of discipleship. The opposite sign, Libra, governs the treading of the path. Interesting, governs the treading of the path. The will to return to the source, and the source is being. So hence Aries' connection with being, Aries' connection with the soul of India, the first ray soul of India, which always emphasizes the Brahman, or the Parabrahman, or the pure being, very fittingly. it is the determination to achieve liberation, and in this respect, let us remember that Uranus is the hierarchical planet in Aries. Uranus the Liberator, Uranus the first ray planet and the first ray sign Aries, that is liberation, liberation from all form. The emanating cause of changes upon the mutable and fixed cross. So let's just say all that happens on these lesser crosses is impulsed from Aries. If we move further, we find Taurus. Taurus on the counterclockwise wheel. Taurus, the desire to overcome desire. Oh, this is a wonderful way of speaking of it. This is, can't really get rid of desire. We can only co-measure our desires. Desire is so absolutely cosmic. It is the great force by which the apparently separated elements of cosmos, separated through the power of emanation, regather and and coalesce and re-cohere. So desire is so cosmic, we're not going to get rid of it, but we will get rid of our lower desires, and that's basically what the Buddha was teaching. The desire to overcome desire. This is the Buddha's great teaching. The longing for liberation, even now existent in Buddhism, a true liberation is the goal. Transmutation of desire into love. Well, it's the second sign. It is the great sign of desire. And in terms of illumination and pure reason, as found on the Buddhic plane, Taurus can be very connected with love, because love is sometimes defined as pure reason. Love defined as pure reason. But this is the desire to overcome desire. It is the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha is the, for our humanity at least, the archetypal Taurian. Then we have Gemini, still on the counterclockwise wheel, the fusion of the opposites, soul and personality, or maybe even spirit and matter in some respect, the intelligent work of at-one-ment and synthesis and intelligence. You know, Gemini has a very strong intelligence. As a matter of fact, is the third ray connected with Gemini? And I would say, yes, it's the third sign. And remember, these are constellational lords, so they have a ray for the monad, a ray for their soul, a ray for their personality. And then, you know, of course, other rays as well that we're not in a position to assess, just the way we're not in too great a position to assess the mental, emotional, and physical rays of the planetary logoi, but we can hazard guesses. The fusion of the opposites, the intelligent work of at-one-ment, synthesis, but let's call it an articulated synthesis, not creating homogeneity, but let's just say variety remains within the achieved synthesis. Variety. All right, the fusion of the opposites. There is a way in which soul and spirit are opposites, and they are fusing under Jupiter and Gemini. There's a way in which personality and soul are opposites. They're fusing under Venus. But intelligence is always found in Gemini. So even though it's a very second ray sign, at least that's what's emphasized when we talk about this sign or this constellation, the third ray is there, an intelligent synthesis is present. All right, so that's on the counterclockwise wheel. And these are signs of commencement or signs of finality. They are signs of commencement on the counterclockwise wheel. They are signs of a kind of finality on the clockwise wheel, in which the individual is again poised to go forth into matter, seeking form, etc. Okay. Gemini, we have experience of the pairs of opposites, all manner of them, perhaps some soul and personality experience, but oftentimes just the contradictions of life. You know, the contradictions, the good and bad of life, the attractive and repulsive. These are experienced by the Geminian, oftentimes caught in the contradiction, pronounced and separative duality. We are sometimes told and we see for ourselves that Geminian people often have a great split between the different sides of their character. In other words, we have a condition of disintegration, so that the different parts of the individual, maybe two parts especially, are not well put together. And that has to be achieved in Gemini eventually under the influence of Venus. The interplay between the twins, soul and form natures. Well, we are, in terms of these climaxes we're talking about, we are coming gradually to the interplay of the soul and form, and that will lead to a more integrated condition. But let's just say that Gemini people on the ordinary wheel have to overcome their splits, the classic split personality, multiple personality even. Now we're moving clockwise, and we're going through Taurus, the refocusing of lower desires, what one really desires in his personality nature prior to another circling of the great wheel in search of personality satisfaction. In other words, can we say, as we think about this process, the moon is exalted in Taurus? Not necessarily positively so. It's not that we're always talking about we're not always talking about the creation of the final form through which soul or spirit can express itself perfectly. No, we're sometimes saying that the lunar indications and the fulfillment of the lunar elementals is a dominating trend under the influence of Taurus. The prodigal son journeys into a far country, let's just say, why so, following his desire nature. So it's lower desire here, and not the white bull, but the black bull, filled with lower desire or desire for form. Now, if in Gemini we were really getting an interplay between soul and personality and not just all of the contradictory possibilities, we might be looking for a higher expression of Taurus here. But it doesn't seem to be occurring. This is very much on a personality level. So Taurus is filled with great wants and great needs and the feeling of entitlement. I deserve this. This must accrue to me. I need this substance. My solar plexus tells me that I need this substance in order to be happy, this matter, this substance. So let's just say the refocusing of lower desires, the next round on the zodiac round will be an acquisitional. We will go forth acquiring on the clockwise wheel. Of course, at some point, you know, there is a kind of a balancing that's going to occur, and a reversal of the wheel will occur, and I wouldn't be surprised not only in Libra, but Aries is involving the reversal of the wheel. These two equinoctial signs, the signs of the equinox, Aries and Taurus, are involved in the balancing. We get to that point when desire is divided, and we are no longer necessarily lunging forward, plowing forward, following the bull of desire into the lower worlds. Desires are being balanced. Some desire for the higher, more invisible, less tangible realities, the higher power, the higher self, something higher. This is realized in Libra, and the impulse to move forward on this new path and begin reversing the wheel is a very Aresian kind of impulse. Remember that Uranus is involved in the reversing of the wheel, but Uranus is the ruler of esoteric ruler of Libra. It also has a very high place in Aries, so it's going in a different direction, different than traditionally matter-oriented direction. It's finally defying lower Saturn. You know, I will confine you to the lower worlds, and all of your desires must be within these lower worlds. No, Uranus helps the individual say, I can go another way. And of course, Saturn is involved in that decision as well, a different level of Saturn. So we're still moving counterclockwise here, and Aries, again the beginning as well as the end. What a way of putting it, you know. Aries, in a way, kind of the alpha and omega. So the beginning is the end is the beginning. And in this particular case, he's emphasizing Aries as the end and the beginning. He's not emphasizing Pisces so much as the end and the beginning. Fortunately, we can get around this by realizing, we can realize that Aries, Pisces, eventually becomes one sign. Now, does Aries Pisces eventually become one constellation? That's another matter. The signs have more to do with how our planet is appropriating the constellational energies. Do we have actual fusions of petals within the heart and the head center of the one about whom naught may be said? Well, who can speculate about that? But heart centers are 12-fold. Do the petals ever start fusing, and does the number become less? That is also, well, it's in the realm of possibility, but it doesn't seem so likely. But when we're talking about signs, we're talking about methods of appropriating, concentrating constellational energy for the use of the planet and for the use of human beings on the planet. And there are different kinds of fusions, as between Libra and Virgo, or Virgo and Leo, or Aries and Pisces, can be achieved. If we eliminated... Well, there was even a time when Libra and Scorpio may have been fused, because Libra was the claws of the scorpion. But this is what we would call numerological reduction. We take a complex figure with X number of parts, and we start reducing the number of parts until we come to that figure with a final number of parts. But I would not want to speculate on that. I'll just say, for the time being, I'm quite happy to leave the heart center with 12 petals, even though the signs may begin to fuse and blend in terms of how humanity can use the energies of the 12 constellations. All right, it should be remembered that Aries is definitely that divine manifestation to which Christ referred when he said, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end." Well, there he is identifying with the pure being. Webinar has ended. All right, I can say this to you on the recording. Suddenly, the webinar has ended after just an hour and 7 minutes. They didn't give me much time, but fortunately, I was at a transitional point, and we'll go on to number 67. So, just imagine the great invocation is being said, and we will go on to number 67.